We do think it's very impactful, and it's important for us to try to get the word out about some of the things that we're finding. So I appreciate Marisa giving a general overview of our NIOSH research program, and I want to talk today about a little of the current phase of research that we're looking at during a process called flowback and production testing operations. I did want to mention one of the products that Marisa had described in her presentation was the NIOSH fact sheet describing, you know, our exposure assessment research. I did bring about 20 or 25 copies of that in the back. It's located on the table. So if anybody wants to take a look at that or take it with you, please feel free to do so. And there's contact information for the industrial hygienists and other scientists who work in this area. So please feel free to contact us afterwards if you have any questions. So I'll go ahead and get started. So again, my topic is going to be our exposure assessments in the upstream oil and gas industry, specifically focusing on exposures encountered during what are called flowback and production testing operations. I have nothing to disclose. So the first question you may ask yourself is, well, you know, I've heard a lot about hydraulic fracturing, and a lot of times people think of that as an all-encompassing activity. And really, that's a very specific activity, and so I want to kind of describe what exactly we mean by flowback and production testing. So as everyone knows, hydraulic fracturing is the process in which a well is drilled. In this example, you can see that this is uses a new technology or fairly new technology called horizontal drilling, and in the process of hydraulic fracturing, a tremendous amount of water and typically sand, which is used as a proppant, is injected into the well at very high pressures, and that fractures or creates fractures in this shale, which then allows the release of hydrocarbons that are trapped in the shale to then come back and up the well and be captured on the ground. So flowback is that period of time after the fracturing of a well, when a lot of those products that had originally been injected, some of that water and other compounds and sand, starts to flow back up the well, is captured, and really it's a period of time that can last anywhere between a few days to several weeks before a lot of the oil and or gas is captured and can be then brought to sales. And so it's, like I said, a period of time when a lot of those original fluids that were injected are captured up on the well. So as you can see here, this is the site of the well injection, and typically there are several tanks on the ground at a well site. There are permanent tanks that are used to capture either the gas or the oil that then go to sales, but then there are also temporary storage tanks called flowback tanks that are on the ground there at the well site only for a particular period of time while a lot of these injected fluids start to come back. For both of those types of tanks, the flowback tanks and the production tanks, there are workers that are required to go up to the top of the tanks, typically open up a thief hatch and do a process called gauging or strapping in which they determine the quantity of levels or the quantity of fluids that are actually in those tanks. So it's a process that could potentially pose some risks of exposure, so we wanted to get a better idea and quantify what those exposures are in this particular process. In doing this phase of research, as I mentioned before, we wanted to specifically identify several factors that could be related to the risks of exposure for the workers doing these types of activities. We wanted specifically to gain more knowledge about what processes and activities are the ones that may pose the greatest risks of exposure, and further elucidate potential sources of exposure when conducting some of these activities. We had a long list of potential exposures that we wanted to investigate for these workers. Obviously, some of the biggest ones would be the volatile organic compounds that could be released when dealing with these fluids. Many of these VOCs include compounds like BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylenes, but a number of other volatilized organic compounds. Other concerns we had were the potential for exposures to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, things like naphthalene. And then we were also interested in seeing, was there the potential for exposure to some of the compounds that are added to the fracturing fluids, things like alcohols, methanol and propargyl alcohol. Those compounds are used as could be used for winterizing agents or as anti-corrosion compounds. Glutaraldehyde, for example, is a typical biocide that's included in fracturing fluids, and we thought, you know, as these fluids come back up, you know, is there potential for exposure to that? Respirable dust and silica, this was a concern, not so much at these particular sites. An earlier phase of our research had really focused on silica during hydraulic fracturing because of the fact that during the transfer of sand, there's a tremendous amount of aerosolized respirable sand in silica. And so that's a topic that one of our next presenters will be discussing. But nothing like that was going on during the flowback phase, but we still wanted to get a sense of whether exposure to respirable dust and silica just from environmental sources. And then the concern about explosive hazards. So we were doing some monitoring using lower explosive limit meters. We've spent several years actually in this phase of our studies. We first started going out in the field in 2013 to do exposure assessments looking at some of these concerns. The sites in orange are the sites that we visited in four site visits in three states in 2013. And then 2015, the year that we're completing now, has been a tremendously busy year for us doing a number of site visits, and those are represented by the sites in blue. So as you can see, our attempt to really get a great idea and get quantitative data from a number of different formations, a number of different basins, during a number of different seasonal time periods, during the winters when it's been quite cold and during the summers when it's been quite warm. And so, like I said, we want to get a much better sense about what we're seeing on a national level. As I mentioned before, these are some examples of the specific worker tasks and activities that we were evaluating. So whenever we go to a particular well site during this phase, there are typically several different types of workers that have specific responsibilities. The first that I've listed here is what's called a flowback tech, and this is an individual who actually does the tank gauging on either flowback tanks or potentially production tanks. So in this photo right here, this is an individual called the flowback tech. He's on the top of one of these rectangular temporary flowback tanks. And as you can see here, the process that they do the gauging is essentially they'll go up to the top of the tank, they'll open up a hatch at the top of the tank, and use what's essentially an oversized dipstick to drop that down into the tank, bring it back up, and they'll get a determination of how much quantity of fluids are in there. It sounds like a very old-fashioned technique to determine the quantity of fluids in a tank, and we agree that it is. And there are probably better ways to do that. And then there are workers, for example, the next on our list is a flowback lead man. Typically, there's a team of flowback techs, one of which is a lead man. This lead man is typically the person that's doing the monitoring of the operations. They probably won't spend a whole lot of time up at the top of the tanks, but will be monitoring gauges and monitoring the work of some of the other flowback techs. And then there are production watch technicians as well, and these may be individuals who are solely interested in gauging and strapping the production tanks. So you can see the difference between the two types of tanks. These in the lower photo are production tanks, and these are the permanent tanks that actually store the hydrocarbons that are coming up throughout the life of the well. But in a similar fashion, there are still individuals who go up to the top of the tank. This is the production watch technician, and he would also open up a hatch on the top of these production tanks and lower either a gauge or a strap that would be able to allow him to make a determination as to what the quantity of fluids are in that tank. So what were the techniques that we were using to conduct our exposure assessments at these sites? Well, there were very traditional industrial hygiene methodologies that I'm sure many of you would find to be familiar. We were collecting full shift and short-term samples for the compounds of concerns that I had listed before. Typically, these are just using sorbent media like charcoal tubes or filters if we were doing something like particulates. And we were particularly focusing in on trying to get data on personal breathing zone measurements, but we were also taking some area air samples as well. We were very fortunate to have some experts on our team that were kind of leading the charge on our using direct reading instrumentation. So we had a number of pieces of equipment that were allowing us to collect personal breathing zone and area air samples specifically in a real-time manner that allowed us to data log throughout the entire shift, looking for both VOCs and for benzene in particular. I'll mention this in a slide following this, but benzene was a particular compound of concern because of its the possibility of its carcinogenicity. But these direct breathing measurements were collected, as I mentioned before, also in their personal breathing zone and as well as in the general area air samples. And because of the possibility of, you know, large concentrations or high concentrations of volatile compounds, we were also very interested in doing monitoring for explosive hazards and seeing what we could find about lower explosive limits being exceeded. As I mentioned before, benzene was one of the compounds of concerns that we really had because of the fact it has very low occupational exposure limits because of the fact that it is a carcinogen. So I just wanted to include this slide because it shows the various occupational exposure limits that are available for benzene. The most conservative occupational exposure limit is from NIOSH. The REL for benzene over full shift time-weighted average is 0.1 parts per million. And as I mentioned before, that's the most conservative. The next most conservative is the TLV from ACGIH, which lists a full shift time-weighted average of 0.5. Above that is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's PEL at 1 part per million. But what's interesting is that there are some industry exceptions for benzene, and the oil and gas industry is one of those exceptions. So that industry is exempted from that 1 part per million time-weighted average, and that sector is then included in a PEL that is even greater than that at 10 parts per million. So you can see that there's a significant difference between, you know, the oil and gas industry OSHA PEL at 10 ppm and NIOSH REL at 0.1 ppm. And typically, when we do exposure assessments, not just for this, but for other industries as well, oftentimes NIOSH makes recommendations based on whatever the most conservative occupational exposure limit is. So in this case, we made a lot of our recommendations based on that benzene REL from NIOSH. So, as I mentioned before, this is was at first one of our kind of major concerns. And so these are the results of the full shift personal breathing zone samples that we collected for benzene. And I just wanted to point out that these are results that represent the data from the 2013 site visits. As I mentioned before, we've done quite a number of site visits throughout 2015 that will add to this data, but we have not yet had a chance to fully analyze all of the data from this year. So this just represents kind of what we found originally from the 2013 data. And we did find statistically significant differences between individuals who were going up to the top of the tanks and doing gauging versus those who were not spending any time on the tanks. And so you can see that this is just the average, time-weighted average. In the red column is for those individuals who are gauging tanks versus those individuals who were not doing any gauging. That average for workers gauging tanks is 0.25 parts per million, which is about 2.5 times the NIOSH REL. So we were finding levels of concern above our NIOSH recommended exposure limit for the individuals who are going up on top of these flowback tanks, and made recommendations based on that. In addition to doing exposure assessment monitoring for compounds like benzene, we also had a team who's interested in looking at biomonitoring to look at the possibility of finding metabolites of benzene in the worker's urine. And so there is a metabolite called S-phenylmercaptic acid, or SPMA, that can be used as a biomarker of exposure to benzene. And so you can see here that the range for the workers that we were monitoring was up to 20.9 micrograms of SPMA per gram of creatinine. And as you can see here, there was a difference, although I don't recall if it was statistically significant, but you can see that there was an increase in this biomarker for benzene for those workers who were gauging tanks at 6.1 versus the average of the workers who were not gauging tanks at 2.5. The good news is that despite the fact that we did see an increase in those workers who were gauging tanks, ACGIH does have a biological exposure index, or BEI, for SPMA as a biomarker for benzene, and that BEI is 25 micrograms of SPMA. So we were not achieving, or we were not finding exposures or levels of the biomarker at the BEI level. So this slide gives a little bit of information about patterns of exposures that we were finding during gauging operations. This chart on the left-hand side gives data on total VOCs of an individual who is gauging a tank 2 times per hour, and this chart on the right shows data for an individual who is not gauging tanks at all. So you can see the considerable difference in exposures to total volatile organic compounds as the individuals made their way up to the tops of the tanks. What's interesting is also to note the time-weighted average benzene. So this data shows direct reading instrumentation data, but we also had sorbent tubes on these individuals so that we could get a full shift benzene concentration. And so, as I mentioned before, we were finding them benzene concentrations higher than the NIOSH REL of 0.1, and for an individual who's not gauging, they did not achieve that exposure level. So for all of the other compounds that we've been monitoring for, honestly, we've found very little of anything of concern. All of the other compounds that we were monitoring for were below any occupational exposure limit, oftentimes below the limit of detection, which we were very glad to see. The thing that we did find concerning was that in our measurements of the explosive limits, the direct reading instrumentation did find many instances of peaks and excursions measuring as high as greater than 40% of the lower explosive limit. So typically, what we would recommend is to have an LEL meter alarm at about 10% of the LEL, which would allow an individual to take action to get out of the area. And so this gives some data about those excursions that you can see of an individual who is gauging tanks. This photo is a photo that we took using an infrared camera, and you can see you can visualize with this very easily the volatile organic compounds that are escaping from an open hatch from this flowback tank. I wanted to do just a short video to say that we actually were really concerned about this issue of explosive and flammable hazards. So I wanted to give you an idea of what it looks like using this infrared camera. Whoops. As an individual opens the thief hatch, you get pretty much this immediate burst of volatile organic compounds that comes out of the open thief hatch. And it's this period of time that you can get tremendous amounts of high concentrations of VOCs. The concern not only is the toxicity associated with high concentrations of VOCs, but also the reduction in oxygen concentration. And there have been some identified fatalities that we feel are associated with this, and that will be a topic that one of our other speakers will talk about. So the concentrations that we were finding so far in some of the low molecular weight hydrocarbons, compounds like methane, ethane, propane, butane, that that very much could cause explosive hazards and reduction in oxygen concentrations. We were finding them up in the, you know, hundreds of thousands of parts per million, hundreds of thousands of ppm concentration range, which is considerably higher than what their IDLH levels are. And so again, it is something of concern that we are trying to get the word out about this particular activity. For 2015, we've just, like I said, had a very busy year, and this graph gives you a little bit of information about the data we've collected this year. We are conducting a lot more analysis on this, so we hope to continue to push this information out to the industry. Conclusions is that exposures to extremely high concentrations of low molecular weight hydrocarbons is an issue that we should really be trying to control better. Worker exposures to benzene are indeed above the NIOSH exposure limits and are present during tank aging activities. One of the things that we want to make sure people are aware of is that in these types of situations, oftentimes, you know, you're dealing with a low oxygen concentration issue, and so half masks and full face respirators may not necessarily be the respirator of choice to deal with these types of exposures. And also that individuals who are working in this area really need to make sure that they're properly trained on how to use multi-gas meters to alert them to when situations like this are occurring. We've developed a number of recommendations, the top of which is the first one I'll discuss, and basically is that we've made recommendations to the industry that they need to develop different ways of monitoring the quantities of fluids in these tanks. There has to be a better way than having an individual going up to the top of these tanks and opening it up and sticking a gauge down there. So there are some alternatives that are being implemented, and can be costly, but we feel like they're definitely worth it when we're talking about situations like this. I think my last slide basically is that NIOSH can only do these exposure assessments at the Partnership of Industries. We don't have right of entry when we're going into these facilities, and we have to be invited in to conduct this research. So whenever we go to these types of conferences, we're always asking for assistance from industry partners or academicians and things like that who may be able to provide us some further inway into being able to collect some of this data. We have communicated a lot of these results through our NIOSH Science blog, through journal articles, through some of the hazard alerts that have been discussed. So we are trying to get the word out about some of the hazards that we found in this industry. So that's the end of my presentation, and I will take any questions at the end. So thank you.